Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. My guest will be Michael Livingston, who is the head of the Sharon Academy in rural Vermont. It's an independent day school, and he is on the show today to share with us some of the trends he sees happening not only in the educational system but in the home life of the students he deals with. And, you know, it's representative of students across the country. So we're going to talk about that. But before we do, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the New York area. And as always, if you send me things that you know of that I might not know of that are going on in the area, I will share them with my listening audience. This weekend coming up is the Roger Smith Conference on Food, and that takes place at the Roger Smith Hotel, and it's from 8 to 5 both Saturday and Sunday. I think there's even some things going on Friday evening, so check into that. April 5th through 6th is the Just Food Conference, which is always a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to do workshops and network and learn a lot about our food system in New York. That's taking place up at Columbia University this weekend. You can find out more information at the Just Food Conference. I believe there's still tickets, but I'm not sure. Last year, I know they sold out. Sunday, April 6th, there's a screening of Triple Divide, which is a great documentary film, and that's being shown at the Riverside Church from 1 to 3 Sunday afternoon. April 12th is a Sustainable Garden Educational Field Day and CSA Fair. That CSA Fair is taking place at Farmingdale State College. But there are CSA Fairs, although it's starting to get late. If you're not yet involved in a CSA, a community-supported agricultural way of buying your organic vegetables, then unless you're growing your own, there's a good chance you're paying more than you really need to. Joining a CSA is one of your best ways of getting really fresh, organic, seasonal, local vegetables into you and your family. So I recommend people joining. Anyway, a CSA fair gives you an opportunity to meet many of the farmers all in one place and shop around for the CSA that's most convenient for you, because that's certainly a big part of it. You need to be able to pick up the food either at the farm or at a drop-off point that the farm has arranged. So anyway, this one is taking place April 12th from 10 to 2 at Farmingdale State College, but there's a whole day workshop and field day going on from 8:30 to 4. So you can find out more information about that on my website at iegreen.com, or you can go to the Sustainability Garden at SUNY Farmingdale website. April 21st is Earth Day. Actually, the 22nd is Earth Day, but there's an Earth Day celebration, a screening of Gasland 2 at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, which is our local cinema where a lot of our slow food events are. And Slow Food Huntington is one of the co-sponsors, along with Food and Water Watch, for this film. So I recommend people coming out to that. That's April 21st at 7:30. May 10th and 11th is the Edibles Communities Publication Edible Institute 2014. That's taking place at the New School. And there's going to be lots of people there, who's who in the food movement and the real movers and shakers in New York. They will be coming together at the New School May 10th and 11th. Lots of great workshops, visits to rooftop gardens, et cetera, et cetera. So find out more about that on the Edible. You can just Google Edible Institute 2014 to find out more information, or I still have that posted on my website. May 13th, Michael Pollan will be talking at the Kaufman Concert Hall on May 13th. That's at the 92nd Street Y. And get your tickets. These tickets are selling out fast. There actually is something going on this Friday evening. Wendell Berry will be speaking with Mark Bittman as the MC. We'll be speaking at Cooper Union at their great concert hall this Friday evening at 6 o'clock. So I know it's sold out, but if you get there early, you might be able to get tickets to that too. May 17th is Run Fast for Slow Food New York City, and that's a, you know, a fundraiser coming up. So, of course, I also want to share with you some of the things going on in and around the news and some things of action that I'd like to call upon all of you to do. As you know, I'm really big on taking action. I mean, we all are witness to the things going on in our world that we're not happy about, whether it's GMOs or the Keystone Pipeline, et cetera, et cetera. There's so many different things going on, and there's always different petitions and ways you can let your legislators know that we are not happy about these situations. And so right now, we are trying to make labeling of GMOs in New York State a law. And there's a petition on my website that you can sign to do this and send it off to your officials up in Albany. And GMO Free New York is a great organization really working for New Yorkers to get labeling laws in this country. Of course, we'd love, or in this state, of course, we would love to see GMOs be something of history and non-existent, but that's not happening anytime in the near future since all the biotech companies are in such cahoots with our so many of our officials. But in the meantime, we need to do what we can to let them know that we're not happy about this situation. We at least want to be labeled, get these foods labeled so we know what we're doing. But you can assume if you're buying processed foods at any traditional supermarket that 90% of them are containing genetically modified ingredients. That's right, 90%. So you really want to avoid processed foods, buy organic. Trader Joe's brands, if they say Trader Joe's, they are supposed to be GMO-free, according to their website. We also want to protect New York water from this Constitution pipeline. I know I've been talking to you a lot about the Keystone Pipeline. That's been in the news for years, but the Constitution Pipeline is new to me, so I assume it may be new to many of you. But this is a pipeline that they're trying to bring over from the Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania, and cross the Hudson River watershed and go from Pennsylvania to New York and New England. This pipeline would cross 20 aquifers, more than 20 private wells, public watersheds. It would also cross 207 water bodies and impact 75 acres of wetland. Really a bad idea. If you, you know, pay attention to the news, you see that these pipelines are leaking everywhere. And this would just really affect all of us living here in the New York area. So we want to keep that from happening. And also there's another big protest taking place on April 26th, a whole alliance of pipeline fighters, you know, starting on the 22nd, they're going to be marching, but they're going to be converging in Washington on April 26th. So you can find out more information about that protest also on my website. And then just this week in the news, there's, you know, more documentation that a plant-rich diet is really linked to longevity and to a healthier lifestyle. And people who eat 7 servings of vegetables and fruits a day are much less likely to get one of the, cancer or high blood pressure, heart disease, those kind of chronic illnesses. So that's a really interesting study. You can read that on my website. This was shocking. I know we all were very happy to hear that the obesity rate went down in kids between the ages of 2 and 5. But people are really saying not to put too much weight onto that because, it could be a skewed study. But this study, 1 to 3 American children has high cholesterol, is pretty shocking. So you can read about that also on my website. And this is exciting. New York City is moving forward to have a disposable bag ban. And they're going to start charging 10 cents every time you use a disposable bag. So hopefully that will really encourage people to walk around with bags in their pockets so that we can reduce the amount of bags that we use. I mean, it's amazing. Right now, currently, New Yorkers throw away 5.2 billion plastic bags per year, and that costs the city $10 million a year to transport those bags into landfills. So just, think about what that's going to do. This bill is aiming to reduce single-use bags by 90%. Pretty amazing. So if this could happen, this would be really big. So those are all great things. Before I invite Michael on, I would like to share with you my recipe. Next week is the beginning of Passover, So many people are looking to many of these traditional Passover foods, so I'm going to share one with you today and then again next week. This is the best vegan macaroon recipe I have worked up yet. You know, I've been playing with turning my vanilla and almond macaroons, which are really great, great macaroons, but they do contain eggs, sugar, and butter. These macaroons are, you know, certainly healthier. They don't have the butter, and they have a lot less sugar, and they are delicious as well. So here's my recipe for vegan macaroons. You're going to start by soaking 2 tablespoons of flaxseed in 1 tablespoon of warm water and 1 tablespoon of apple cider vinegar. And let that sit for a while. And I use flaxseed often as an egg substitute. It congeals as it sits there in the water and kind of helps bind these macaroons together. Then 1/2 cup of organic sugar you will need, 1/4 cup of organic maple syrup, 1/4 teaspoon baking powder, 6 tablespoons coconut oil, 2 1/2 cups of unsweetened shredded coconut, 1 1/2 teaspoon vanilla extract, 1 teaspoon of almond extract, that's optional, and also chocolate chips are optional. In a large bowl, you're going to beat the coconut oil together so it's smooth. And I actually usually heat the coconut oil on the stove just for a little bit so it really liquefies, because you want it to be liquid when you're mixing it into this recipe. I add the maple syrup into that and mix that all up. Then I added the soaked flax seeds into the coconut oil and maple syrup and mix that up. So that's really, you know, all the liquid ingredients are together. Then in the bowl, I add the coconut, the vanilla extract, the baking powder, and mix that all together and pour the coconut oil mixture into that. And mix it all up, add the vanilla extract to the whole batch. Then I divide the batter in half, and with 1/2 of it, I add an almond extract to that. Then I place the macaroons on a well-greased cookie sheet, and I, you know, keep separate the ones that are just vanilla and the ones that are almond. And then the ones that are almond, I garnish with 3 almond slivers on the top of the peak. Macaroons traditionally are, you know, you put them down almost like a giant kiss, the shape of a kiss, you know, chocolate kisses. That's the shape, but it's much bigger. Then you make those little peaks, and then you put the almonds on the top for the almond ones. And then the vanilla ones I leave plain, and usually I like to melt some chocolate chips, and then I drizzle the melted chocolate on top of the vanilla ones to make, you know, chocolate-coated macaroons. And they're delicious. So you're going to bake these at a 350 oven for 10 minutes, then lower the oven to 250 and bake them for another 5 to 8 minutes. Everyone's oven is different. Usually when I lower the oven from 350 to 250, I turn my pan around because my oven is hotter in the back. And they make about 25 cookies. So enjoy. I love feedback, so give me feedback, and I'll share another Passover recipe with you next week. And now it's my pleasure to invite on a dear friend of mine. Michael Livingston is the head of the Sharon Academy, which is a rural, which is a small independent school in rural Vermont. And he's the headmaster after teaching there for many years. And he's been involved in teaching or some part of education for over 35 years. And as the headmaster, Michael's responsible for all aspects of running the school, from educational programming and curriculum to offering guidance to the students and everything in between. He also had been the co-director of the Mindfulness Practice Center in Woodstock, Vermont, which is the teachings of the world-renowned Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh. And this work that he's done with mindfulness informs all the work he does at the school, so that he brings a real sense of balance and calm to the school community and to the students and parents. So it's my pleasure now to introduce Michael. Are you with me, Michael?
I am, Bhavani. Thank you so much.
Sure. How are you?
I'm great. We're in the beginning throes of mud season here in Vermont, so it's the fifth season of the year, and
right,
always good
right
for lots of excitement.
Uh-huh. I'm sure. So can you share with us, before we get into some of the real questioning, what inspired you to go into education? You know, I always, you know, traditionally people have thought of education more as a woman's line of work, and there's many less men that go into especially elementary school teaching. Can you share with us what inspired you?
Well, I think it was actually something that I had always known and never really firmly sort of touched or understood until I was graduating from college and wondering, as my father often did, what in the world I was going to do with a history degree, and realized that I was actually on my way home from a volunteer job working with kindergartners, and that the very first job I'd ever had in seventh grade was volunteering to work with middle school students, and that I'd always been interested in working with children. And so there was just a sort of a real moment of clarity near the end of my college career, which is a fortunate thing. And so I started working with elementary school students in public schools for about 22 years before I got involved with independent school education.
Uh-huh. You know, I think it's like medicine for me, anyway, being around children. I, you know, don't work with them on a regular basis anymore, even though I do have my Waldorf teaching certification. You know, I'm not in a school setting, but I've just finished a five-week after-school program, Cooking with Kids, and it is just the best, being in the classroom with them. You know, the insight, you know, I remember the first day in this class, I asked the kids, you know, why did you want to take this junior chef cooking class? And when they start off going, well, I've always liked to cook ever since I was little, it just cracked me up.
Right.
They're so cute, and they think they're so old, and it's just delightful to see the world through children's eyes. I think it's really, people who get to work around kids are very lucky.
They are, and your story is great because children who are so young are simultaneously so old and very wise, and so the typical scenario that we consider that the adults are the educators and the children are the recipients of all this teaching and learning is really, when you spend time with children, it really gets turned upside down. I learn more from children every day than I could possibly disseminate over many, many days. And so it's really a privilege, and it is a lot of fun. They're charming, they're funny. They're incredibly insightful. They're maddening and frustrating, and they're also our future.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, what is it that you like most about teaching?
Well, I've transitioned from elementary school education to teaching at the high school level to becoming a pretty much a full-time administrator, I still really enjoy and am called to spend time with children. So I spend most of my time out of my office, either in the hallways or in, you know, major common areas talking to children or bringing them back and spending time in my office talking. So I think that it's the opportunity to exchange, and it really is an exchange, wisdom and insight, if we have any wisdom and insight to offer them, and really sort of build trust and respect, because those two ingredients are the absolutely necessary ingredients for any relationship if it's going to be successful. And I think that we need to be paying more attention to our young people, not less, and particularly in this day and age with mass media and gaming and single-parent families and a huge recession in 2008, they really need our time. So I find it just to be incredibly rewarding to just spend time with them.
Right. Well, you just touched on a lot of things in that last sentence, and I'd like to break some of that apart a little bit and start with, like, what are some of the biggest changes you've seen in education, and how do some of those changes that you've seen in society, whether it's technology or family structure, how do you see all of those things changing the students that you're seeing in the school?
Well, now you're going to get me going, Bhavani. So there are many, many changes, and I think the thing that's difficult for many of us to understand, myself certainly included, is how rapidly those changes are taking place. So previously, significant changes in society might take place over decades. We're now seeing transformations, I think, between and within decades. So We'll start with technology, and it's, you know, I would say obviously both a blessing and a curse. Our school, like many, is very dependent. Shared documents are, I don't know what our administrative team would do without Google Documents, for instance, for sharing information. But it's changed the way that information flows, and so educators are no longer the holders of specific information to pass on to others. You have a student in your classroom who could be fact-checking anything you say with their cell phone at any point in time. So how we access and who accesses information has changed a power curve in a very significant way, and that is quite extraordinary, and not necessarily a bad thing, obviously, at all. The problem is that that same technology is in the hands of children from a young age, and I work with a population of, you know, 13 through 18, who do not have fully developed left prefrontal cortexes, so their executive functioning skills are not great, and I think maybe we can come back to that at some point. And so you have this real powerful technology that, frankly, is addictive, both in terms of video gaming and even just the social media, in the hands of kids who don't really know how to regulate it, and it is rewiring their brains. And so the kids that we're getting in schools today think differently, and they're being taught by adults who don't understand that change. And so that's a huge, huge change. And we're seeing that it evolves really in, you know, over 2 or 3 years at a time. So my oldest daughter, who's 27, does not have the same relationship with technology as my son, who's 25. And they're completely different than my younger daughter, who's 22, who bears no resemblance to the 13 and 14-year-olds in my middle school today.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I know you have Waldorf teaching background. you sent your children to Waldorf schools, and as did I. And yep. I know there's been a lot of news lately. I just heard something on public radio a few days ago about the Waldorf schools really getting a lot of media about the fact that they do not introduce technology, and they're actually anti-technology for young kids until they get into the middle school ages. What do you think about that?
Well, honestly, I think it makes a tremendous amount of sense. And the more that we watch the changes that are taking place, I think the more anecdotally, at the very least, we can support that. You know, it's really fascinating to see that there are preschools and daycares in the United States that are having to introduce the concept of play to young children. So dress them up, get them outside, which can be a challenge in and of itself, and then teach them to do things like jump off of rocks or swing from a branch. And so a lot of our children don't play as much, and it's crucial for their development socially, emotionally, spiritually, and certainly academically, cognitively. So I think it makes a lot of sense that we do an annual parent potluck before the start of school with families and children every year. And this year, I asked parents to take back their routers. I think I may get buttons printed out that says take back your router. And, you know, really, who's controlling media access at the house, the kids or the adults? And I think in many ways we need to start acting more like adults and taking more responsibility for maintaining some sense of what our kids are doing online, because, frankly, we have no idea.
Right, right. I remember, and again, you know, the difference in just the last 10 years, as you said, is so traumatic, but or so huge. But I remember, you know, my children did not have computers in their rooms. The computer was in the family room where
yep.
I could see what was going on. And I know, you know, they thought that was mean and terrible, but I know it kept them online, you know. They kept, not online, but it kept them, you know,
in line.
And on track doing what they said they were doing, as opposed to going to sites and getting sidetracked. I mean, I just can't imagine, you know, a child alone in their room having access to everything that's on the internet. Just
well, it's a really good point again. And in that same conversation with parents last summer, I really implored them. There's a lot of really good research that suggests that kids really shouldn't be working up in their rooms, that they're doing things, but they're not doing what they really need to be doing, and that's the business of their work. And So working at the kitchen table in a family room where any computer screen faces in towards the room as a way, as opposed to out and away, so that parents actually have some sense of what their kids are doing, because they're very facile at moving and operating between multiple screens. And, you know, just one area that parents really need to be concerned and thinking about is the incredible prevalence of pornography on the Internet and the incredible amount of time our kids are spending accessing it. And that's a whole subject, Bhavani, that you could probably spend an entire show discussing with your listenership. But just that is of enormous concern to many of us.
Mm-hmm. And how do you see technology being used even in bullying? I mean, bullying has become such a, you know, has become so much more prevalent, and, or I should say, awareness of it. I think it always took place, but bullying used to be just on the school ground, you know, within your little school. But now it can be blasted to the world. Do you, as an administrator, have to get involved in that, and how does that work in your school?
Well, all of us in education need to be involved in that conversation, and it needs to be one that takes place continuously. It can't be an announcement or an assembly and then left. That clearly doesn't work. All of us are increasingly required by statute to be reporting and following through in the state of Vermont, and I have no idea in New York, but I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't the same. There are actually mandatory policies that boards in both independent as well as public schools must adopt that are the baseline. You can't be operating with anything less. And they're very specific and they're very stringent, and they address bullying and harassment both. And, you know, when you have the power of a tool that allows you to communicate as far and wide and as rapidly as current technology does, and again, we'll get back to this issue of executive functioning. When you have children who really aren't very good at all, in many cases actually very poor, at assessing and addressing the consequences of texting out and sending out information, it's really a recipe for disaster. And so there's some things, many things that get said in a text or an instant messaging or any one of the new formats that nobody could imagine actually saying to someone else, but gets sent out on a regular basis. So it's something we have to really keep our eyes on. In our school, we let students bring their phones to school, and we let them use them during their free time. We'll take them away in class if they're using them. Mm-hmm. But in a rural environment, we have kids coming from 12 different towns, weather, circumstances, family issues. It's an important communication tool, and it becomes an increasingly important study and research tool. So we have to find our balance with it. I don't think it would work at all in our instance, for instance, to ban them or take them away.
Right. Yeah, I remember, you know, years ago when my kids were at the Waldorf School and cell phones were just starting, they didn't allow them. But, you know, times have changed just in those, you know, 13 years, 15 years. A lot has changed, as you said. I mean, you know, a decade now is like, you know, 50 might have been in the past.
It's very different. We have, you know, one of the statistics that's incredibly revealing is there are at least four times as many single parents as there were in the 1960s. And those parents, many of them moms with multiple children and jobs, maybe even multiple jobs, are constantly trying to figure out effective, you know, ways to reach their kids, and because plans are constantly changing. And, you know, so from that standpoint alone, it's a necessary tool for many families. But uh-huh. It's also easy to see literally the sort of addictive nature of it. Many of the kids, not many, but a number of them in our small school, almost operate as if their cell phone was an extension of themselves.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you know, well, one thing, when you touched on, you know, the family life and single parents, I mean, you know, what is it, one in two kids nowadays are being raised by a single parent? I think it's that high.
It's very high, and many kids are being raised by three or more parents. The divorce rate, going between multiple houses, changing expectations, different expectations in those households, can be very, very confusing for children.
Uh-huh. not to change the subject, but I also wanted to go back to right now. I think it was this week on the, in the news, I saw some like third grader or fourth grader being suspended from school because he made a gun with his hand. Did you recall seeing that in the news? You know,
no.
At what point, you know, there is zero tolerance. We were talking about bullying. That's what made me think of it. Zero tolerance for the bullying, and if we find out about bullying and having to address that. You know, there's also, you know, kids play, and kids have always made a gun shape with their fingers, even though I never allowed my kids to have guns, per se, you know, toy guns or anything like that. But they'd find a stick in the shape of a gun, and they'd, you know, there was always like that kind of play. Where do you see the line? You know, are people getting, is it getting blown out of proportion, do you think, when a third grader gets suspended from school for making a gun shape with his hand?
Well, I, you know, not understanding any of the other background to that and just taking that at face value, absolutely, I can't imagine. I mean, I think that, you know, we obviously have good reason to be very, very concerned about violence in general in our society, violence against women, violence against people of color,
violence against children.
Children, violence against the entire queer community. I mean, there are lots of reasons to be concerned, and so I can understand that someone would want to address that, but how you would address that, I think is, you know, is really the subject there. And I think that, you know, whether or not we're in a punitive versus a restorative slash therapeutic environment is, I guess, the place that I would focus. And I tell our students all the time, I'm trying to help operate and maintain a community that looks at sort of the therapeutic and restorative value of work as opposed to simply the punitive approach. Because, again, one of the things that we're seeing in the last 15 or 20 years is a tremendous amount of information on brain research. And we understand much better now how teenagers think and what their capacities, and younger children as well, and we get back to executive functioning. The decision-making of a small child is and should not expect it to be that of an adult or even an adolescent. And I think for a child of that age to be taken out of school, and again, we don't know the context of any other background, but
right.
If that was a single event, it certainly wouldn't have been an action that I would have taken. I think that what we need to be doing is spending an awful lot of time working with and educating our communities about violence.
Right.
And
right.
A big, big case here in New Hampshire, but very close by here at Dartmouth College, with a rape case which was just settled in court and did not find the victim guilty. And it is fascinating to read the articles and the letters to the editor there. We've got a long way to go as a culture in understanding our relationship to violence.
Now, when you say victim, you're talking about the person being accused of the rape or the person that
the
was...
The person who was accused of the rape, the perpetrator, was exonerated and...
victim I think of as the person was raped.
Yeah, the victim, victim who pressed charges, they found against her and in favor of the perpetrator. And, you know, it's just interesting to look at and read the accounts and look at our values as a culture and what we consider and what we weigh. And, you know, the place of women and children, minorities, again, the queer community, there are a lot of vulnerable populations, and children are certainly one of them.
Right, right. If you could just share with people, because I know when people think of independent schools, especially down in New York where I live, if you think of independent schools, you think of it as a school where most of the kids are coming from wealthy backgrounds because they cost extra and public school is available to everyone in towns around here. But your situation is a little different. So if you could just share with people a little bit what makes your independent school different so that the population of your student body is more diverse.
Well, Vermont has a very unusual relationship to independent schools because the first schools in Vermont were really independent schools. Public education started well after the establishment of a number of very old and well-established independent schools here. So Thetford Academy, which is not far away, has been in existence for almost 195 years, I believe. So there are also many, many very small towns in Vermont, for any of your readers or listeners, rather, who've been up this way. 93 of our 270-some-odd towns actually don't have either an elementary school and or middle or high school. They're just too small, and it's not viable for them to try and maintain and operate one. So those towns actually have choice, a voucher system, if you will, and those children are allowed to go to any approved public or independent school in the state, and there's a certain amount of money that will follow them.
Right.
So there's a, I would call it a quasi-formula to determine that amount of money, which is quite a bit less than the state average, the actual average. But nonetheless, there is this really very intriguing choice option for many of those families. Now, that's a very small, it's a third of our towns, but it's a very small percentage of the actual populations. These towns are very small. But my school draws 7 through 12, it's a day school, from predominantly seven area towns. So about 87% of our student population is publicly funded. These are families who could be sending their children to literally any approved public or independent school in the state of Vermont. And it's a,
their towns pay for it, so they don't have to have the money to pay for it.
Nope, it's not enough money for us to be able to pay for those students' education. So we fundraise annually for in the neighborhood of $1,250 to $1,500 per student to meet our operating costs. It's the school system. Ours is still extremely frugal, but it's a. It's a very, very interesting model and would be very foreign to most people in most states. It is not a charter school. There's actually no charter school legislation in the state, and you all are going through an amazing statewide discussion right now about charter schools, which I'll be fascinated to hear more about.
Right, we are. Anyway, Michael, when we come back, I want to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, then I really want to talk about where food might play into some of this learning curve.
Be great.
And I'd be interested in what your thoughts are on that. But don't go anywhere. We will be right back. Everyone listening, you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network and my guest, Michael Livingston, the headmaster at the Sharon Academy in Vermont. Be right back. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Michael Livingston, the headmaster at the Sharon Academy in Vermont. And we're talking about the latest trends in schools these days and some of the challenges that we are all facing. Michael, are you with me?
I am.
Great. So I wanted to talk a little bit. I mean, we touched on the fact that so many kids are being raised in single-parent homes. You know, and when you don't have an at-home parent and mom's working all day and coming home and, you know, how do you see that affects the nutrition and the food that the kids are eating these days? Are they, you know, living on fast food? Are they bringing good food to school? Do you have a cafeteria at your school? How does food work? Because I know in Vermont, unlike New York State, they really, you know, are doing a lot of things to bring healthier food into the school system. With gardens and things like that. So can you share with us where where you see nutrition playing a part of the kids?
Well, Bhavani, it increasingly is playing a role. And since 2008, after what I would call the depression, not the recession of 2008, it's really been increasingly clear that food and nutrition and the school and that relationship and communities is playing an increasingly important role. So we see more and more students come to school hungry. They haven't eaten. They don't have food. I worry about hydration as well, a separate subject. But so what we've done is move from a school that had no cafeteria or a food program or function to one where just recently in our middle school, we've formed a partnership with a local elementary school, the public elementary school. It's a fascinating relationship to bring in lunch every day, a very affordable lunch. And the initiative up here in Vermont is that any student who qualifies for free or reduced lunch would get a free lunch as well as a breakfast. And so we'll be doing the same thing with our middle school. And the high school receives two meals a week, and the needs there have increased dramatically as well. And so it's our hope that as we start the following school year, we'll have both a daily lunch program available free to free and reduced families, as well as a breakfast. Because, you know, the kids come to school at in our school at 8:15, which is a relatively late start for a school nationally, and many of them, in terms of their biorhythms, are really not even yet awake. So they've been coerced out of bed by family members, rolled into an automobile, and brought to school, and they're not even awake. They're certainly, many of them, not even ready to eat. So when we have food available for them in the morning, the fascinating thing is to see that at 8:15 they walk right by it. And at the end of their first period class, our classes are an hour and 15 minutes, they devour it. So in that time frame somewhere, they've actually woken up.
Uh-huh.
And the need is incredible. Those same kids will eat an enormous lunch. And we have many of our students participate in activities after school. During basketball season, we could easily have kids on our campus from 8 o'clock in the morning until 8 o'clock at night. And they need another substantial meal in the afternoon as well. So, you know, they're growing enormously in all capacities, and the family situation has made it increasingly difficult for people to organize food, afford the food, and as you were pointing out at the start of your show, just the issues around nutrition value and what it is we're eating, GMOs, is, you know, another huge part of that conversation.
Right.
So,
right.
So our role and our relationship to food changes, it's changing very quickly, and the ability to inform and work with our kids. And I was delighted to hear you talking about cooking with children. It really can be a tremendous amount of fun. One of our Spanish teachers right now, who's from Colombia and has lived in Mexico for most of her life, is doing a Mexican cooking cuisine class with children, and it is a delight to watch. So.
Right.
I think spending more time with those activities is actually something that's going to be becoming increasingly important. But there's a whole nother aspect of food and our relationship to food. I mean, food obviously is essential. It nourishes us, but it also brings us together. And, you know, Bhavani, I don't know many people who know and understand that better than you. And it's true in communities, but it's also true of families. And it's important to think about what actually happens during those interactions. So while you're eating in a group setting, what takes place there is also really important for us to
Right. I remember we were talking together about the family meal, and I think that's what you're alluding to, you know, the family meal that doesn't happen in most families anymore.
No,
so share with us what happens. What do kids learn by sitting at the table with their family?
Well, first of all, the shape of the family is completely different, and you know, there may be some who lament something that's, you know, that was, but it's forever changed, and particularly when you add, again, you know, the economic challenges to it, single parenting is incredibly difficult. But what happens when families or groups of people, whatever the family configuration is, sits down and eats together, is there's incredible modeling that takes place. And, you know, it's really incredible to think about how much love, respect, flexibility, discussions around boundaries, humor, what's appropriate and what isn't, decision-making, time management, all of those factors and characteristics are part of any time we sit down and eat together. And if you're a young child, and you're eating regularly and at the table together with your family, however that's constituted, then you've had thousands and thousands of opportunities to observe and understand all of those things and be able to integrate them. And so as school personnel, as educators and staff, we're seeing fewer and fewer kids come to school with any real experience in, you know, flexibility, time management, decision making, more and more issues with boundary, less issues with flexibility. And, you know, it's just interesting to note that the one place where so much of that instruction is offered, and no one actually ever thinks of it as instruction, is around the family table.
Right. Right. I think we were talking about how, you know, a child from when they're little, and when you talk about modeling, I mean, coming from the Waldorf philosophy, you and I know, but those listening might not realize that kids, especially when they're young, up until age 7, they do almost all of their learning through watching and seeing and modeling. Yep. And imitating who they see. So the activities that you do every day is what they're seeing, and that's what they're learning. And so when they're at the family table and they're seeing dialogue happening of, you know, compromise. I think we were talking about, you know, I'll pick you up at 5 after I drop so-and-so off. But if so-and-so can't make it to this thing or we're running late, then I'm going to call so-and-so to get you. And, you know, all that kind of maneuvering. You know, I think that's what you're talking about, that maneuvering and flexibility of, you know, you have a plan, but if something else changes, you know, this is what will happen as repercussions from that change, and that we all have to go with it.
Yeah, they're just, you know, and again, I don't think that we think of that as family members as instruction, but it is instructive, and it's terribly important. And it also brings the group together, hopefully at a time when technology is put aside, when you can focus and be appreciative of the food that you have. So many don't. And so it's a bit of a moment out of you know, of potentially a very hectic and fast-paced lifestyle that we tend to live. And it's increasingly difficult for families and parents to put it, to pull it off, because there's so many expectations on our children. You know, when you think about, Bhavani, even going back to when you and I were kids growing up, you know, many, many evenings outside playing, you know, building forts, kick the can, hide and seek, whatever. I mean, those were really the only options. You know, we grew up without television. I remember seeing the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show down the road at someone's house, the only TV in the neighborhood. And, you know, wow, think of the difference. We live in a culture where there's this incredible paradox around choice, because everybody thinks they're supposed to have sort of unlimited options. And it's very, very difficult for young children to be able to ultimately manage that responsibility.
Uh-huh. Another thing that has been in the news is drugs. I mean, it's not new in the news, but, you know, the amount of heroin that we're now seeing in schools, and I know there's a big article in the New York Times about the heroin problem in Vermont, and I know it's also down here. It's not like it's only to Vermont, but you know, I had seen a study that I thought less kids were doing drugs because they actually aren't bored, because they have so much time, you know, playing video games and things that, you know, I certainly don't like, but it's something that was occupying kids' time. And if they're going to play a video game versus doing drugs, well, then maybe it's not so bad. Can you share some light on where you see that? You know, how does the increased use of drugs in some of the rural areas, how is that playing an impact on the educational system, or why do you think that's happening in lieu of all this technology?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. The governor in the state of Vermont, Peter Shumlin, really has created quite a conversation nationally. He dedicated his entire State of the State address this year to what he calls an epidemic of opiate abuse and heroin in the state, and it's just generated a tremendous amount of attention, and I think very much needed attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see I see us living, Bhavani, in a culture of uncertainty, all of us. You think about your opening remarks and all of the activities and actions that people can be considering and getting involved in, and the way that we are communicating all of that through the internet, messaging. You know, it's just we're pummeled with you know, lots and lots of questions. Climate change. We just did two big workshops at our high school yesterday with all the students. And, you know, the presenters are trying to give us some opportunity for hope, but the message isn't great.
Right.
We're looking at tremendous uncertainty, uncertainty in terms of jobs, uncertainty in terms of income, uncertainty in terms of abilities to even pay back a modest college loan. So I think that in a culture of uncertainty and after a serious, I would again call it a depression in 2008, I think that you're seeing a lot of people self-medicate. That's frankly the population I am very concerned about. I think we have a lot of people in our, we talked about vulnerability earlier, who a lot of people in our society are incredibly vulnerable. They're in a lot of pain, and they'll, if they find an outlet or an anecdote to that, they will. And so my concern is both for the people in our culture who have a propensity towards addiction and addictive behavior of any kind, in this case with drugs, and the prevalence I see of increasing anxiety and depression, and those two are very closely related. And so if you have undiagnosed anxiety and depression, in this case in an adolescent population, which I think is very much the case, I think those students are going to turn towards whatever ability they have to self-medicate. So pot use is pretty widespread, Bhavani, and people who ultimately turn to painkillers and then heroin, which is relatively inexpensive. Certainly very inexpensive compared to trying to purchase opiates, pain medication. You know, we've got a serious, serious problem, and I think it's actually a mental health problem.
Yeah. Well,
and,
you know, there's there's a lot of things to be depressed about, so it's,
well,
you know,
there are,
there's no good, there's no good answer. There's not like saying, well, you know, it'll be gone tomorrow, because it's not going to be gone tomorrow.
No, I think that, you know, again, just to touch on a presenter yesterday, one of them talked about the need for resilience. And I think that learning resiliency, both as individuals, as small organizations and communities, and even in the world, is going to be a really necessary ingredient for us if we're going to see our children move forward into the future successfully. And, you know, there are just enormous challenges facing all of us, and many of them are going to land squarely in their laps. And so I think that we have to be able to, you know, have these conversations, think about how to help them be resilient, and also share hope. And, you know, it's quite a job, and there are fewer and fewer resources at the national and state level. And so I think you're going to begin to see schools and small communities reach out to each other to try and figure out how to support each other, and in particular our children.
Yeah. Well, Michael, we're just about out of time, and I would like to say, you know, thank you, first off, for your insight and your expertise and the work you do with children. But if you could just quickly just, you know, share with any our listeners, you know, if there was one thing you think that they could do to, if, you know, if they're parents of school-age children, what's the one thing, if they were to change one thing, that you would say would make the biggest impact in all the things we've discussed?
Well, that's easy, Bhavani. We need to take the time to listen. And that means we have to stop being as busy for part of our day as many of us are, myself included, and take the spend some time, good time with children, and to listen to them, and simply
thank
doing
you.
That
perfect
a huge impact.
Perfect. Thank you, Michael. Thanks for joining us. Thank
Bhavani,
you, as
pleasure.
I said, for your wisdom. And everybody out there who's been listening, you've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today has been Michael Livingston, the headmaster at the Sharon Academy. Academy in Vermont. Have a great rest of the day, everyone, and I'll see you again next week. And let me know if you like those vegan macaroons. Have a great one. See you next week. Bye-bye.